Ella, as if she had lived them herself. In the interior vista, she saw through Carista's eyes as she worked alongside other slaves at a sorting and cleaning table on a dock near the edge of the rugged reef. A breeze carried the biting odors of the sea to her nostrils. The morning sky was typically dreary and overcast. White gulls hopped along the faux wood dock, looking for crustacean fragments and tiny morsels of meat that might fall off during the processing operations. A scaly, intimidating Phibian overseer walked up and down the sorting line, his body reeking of rotted fish. He watched the work and periodically checked to make certain that none of the Bene Gesserit slaves had stolen anything. Carista wondered where she could possibly go if she did try to steal a Sioux stone fragment. She had been in exile on Boozle for almost 2 decades, first cast out by the Sisterhood as a young woman, then trapped as a slave to the whores from the scattering. Carista had been sentenced to Boozle for what the Bene Gesserits called a crime of humanity. She had been ordered to breed with a spoiled, petulant nobleman who pranced about in a different outfit every time she saw him. Following the orders of her breeding mistresses, Carista had seduced the fop, whom she could not imagine loving, and had manipulated her internal chemistry to ensure that the resulting child would be a daughter. From the moment of conception, the daughter had been destined for the Bene Gesserit order. Carista had known that intellectually, but not in her heart. As the child grew in her womb, Carista began to have misgivings, especially when the baby started to move and kick. Alone with herself, she got to know her daughter before she was born and began to imagine raising the girl as her own, being a traditional mother to her, a practice that was forbidden in the Sisterhood. In spite of the strictness of the various breeding programs, there had to be room for exceptions, for some degree of love. Each day, Carista talked soothingly to the baby in her womb, uttering special blessings. Gradually, she began to think about escaping from her oppressive obligations. One night, as she sang mournfully to her unborn child, Carista made the fateful decision to keep her baby. She would not turn the little girl over to the breeding mistresses as ordered. Carista fled into seclusion, giving birth alone in an unlit shelter like an animal. A stern breeding mistress named Monaya discovered where she was and stormed in, accompanied by a black-robed squadron of enforcers. After knowing only a few hours of her mother's love, the newborn daughter was taken away, and Carista never saw her again. She hardly remembered the subsequent journey to Boozle, where she was abandoned with the other discarded sisters to remain for the rest of her life in the penance program. During all the years Carista spent here on patches of black land no larger than a prison yard, surrounded by oceans, she never stopped thinking about her lost daughter. Then the honored Matres swept in like savage carrion birds, slaughtering thousands of Bene Gesserit exiles on Boozle. Only a handful of sisters were spared to be put to work as slaves. Whenever the rank iodine smell announced the presence of the Phibian overseers, Carista worked faster to sort the precious stones by color and size. Behind her, the damp, amphibious man moved on, breathing heavily from gills that worked to suck oxygen from air instead of seawater. Fearing punishment, Carista never looked at the Phibian. In her first year of captivity, she fumed, wishing she could find some way to get her child back. As time passed, she lost all hope of that and began to accept her circumstances. For years, she lived from moment to moment, only rarely picking at the mistakes of her past like someone worrying at a loose tooth. The deep waters of Boozle became the limits of her universe. She and her fellow survivors did not actually dive for the deep water stones. Phibians did that. Genetically modified hybrids created out in the scattering, the human amphibian creatures had bullet-shaped heads, lean and streamlined bodies, and slick green skin that shone with oily iridescence. She was fascinated by them and feared them. Then, years ago, Carista had rescued an abandoned Phibian baby from the sea, concealing and tending it in her simple hut for months. She nurtured her sea child back to health, but then, in a cruel echo of her earlier experience, honored Matres snatched the hybrid baby from her. Having heard of her previous experience, the whores taunted Carista, calling her the woman who lost two babies. They openly ridiculed her, while her fellow exiled sisters quietly admired her. Shaken, Mirbella withdrew from contact with the disgraced sister to find that only a moment had passed. In front of her, Carista blinked back at her in amazement at the flood of news and information. Sharing went both ways, and now the punished Bene Gesserit woman knew everything the Mother Commander knew. It was a gamble Mirbella had been willing to make. Considering how swiftly her Valkyries had succeeded in securing all vulnerable points, Mirbella was certain that the new sisterhood could easily run the operations here. She would leave a defensive force in orbit, convert or kill the remaining honored Matres, and get back to work. She glanced around for Phibian guards, but they had all vanished into the deep water with the arrival of the Valkyries. They would return. Sharing with Carista had told her all she needed to know. Reverend Mother Carista, I appoint you overseer of the Sisterhood's Soustone operations. I know that you are aware of many flaws, as well as the ways the work process could be improved. The woman nodded, her eyes shining with pride that Mirbella had entrusted her with these new responsibilities. Red-faced with rage, Matres Skira was barely able to control herself. If any other honored Matres prove to be a problem, you have my permission to execute them. 2 days later, satisfied with the changes underway and ready to return to Chapter House, Mirbella walked back through the weathered settlement at dusk. She passed between locked soustone holding sheds and a hodgepodge of living quarters and administrative buildings. Glow globes surged on inside the buildings as night swiftly fell under a coppery orange blanket of sunset. 4 honored Matres emerged from the deep shadows of an equipment shed and the doorway of a dark building. Though they crept forward, clearly intending to be stealthy, Mirbella spotted them immediately. Their violent intent rose from them like noxious fumes. Tingling and ready for a fight, she regarded them with disdain. The 4 women stalked forward, confident in their numbers, though honored Matres rarely managed to fight efficiently as a team. Combat with several of them would simply be a brawl. The honored Matres rushed her. In a blur of motion, Mirbella kicked and spun repeatedly, cutting through all 4 of them. A choreographed synthesis of Bene Gesserit combat methods and honored Matre fighting tricks, overlaid with a pattern of Duncan's swordmaster techniques. Any one of her Valkyries could have done the same. In less than a minute, the attackers lay dead. Another group of angry honored Matres boiled out of the equipment sheds. Mirbella prepared for a grander fight and laughed aloud. She could feel her body singing with the call of combat. Will you make me kill all of you? Or should I leave one alive as a witness to discourage further nonsense? Who else will try? 2 more did. And 2 more died. Confused, the rest of the honored Matres hung back. To be sure that her message had sunk in, Mirbella taunted them. "Who else will face me?" She pointed to the fallen bodies. "These six have learned the lesson." No one accepted the challenge. 13 years after escape from Chapter House. On a moment's notice, a friend can become a competitor or a dangerous enemy. It is essential to analyze the probabilities at all times to avoid being taken by surprise. Duncan, Idaho, Mentat Observation. The rabbi hurried down the corridor with a scroll under his arm, muttering, "How many more will you create?" He had built his arguments, compiling proofs from Talmudic writings, but the Bene Gesserits were not impressed. They could quote as many obscure prophecies back at him and baffle him with mysticism that went far beyond his own. As Duncan Idaho strode past the spry, bespectacled man, the rabbi was too preoccupied even to notice him. The sight of him in the corridor outside the med center and the Gola creche had become commonplace over the years. Several times a week, the rabbi looked in on the axolotl tanks, praying over the woman he had known as Rebecca and peering in at the group of strange, tank-incubated children. Though entirely harmless, the poor fellow seemed out of touch, clinging to a reality that manifested only in his mind and in his guilt. Even so, Duncan and the others tried to show him the respect he deserved. After the rabbi left, Duncan also watched the Gola children as they interacted with one another like normal children, unaware of their previous personalities. The Tleilaxu master Saiteo kept his Gola apart from the other children, but the 8 historical Golas, ranging in age from 1 to 7 years, were raised together. They were all extremely bright and flawless cellular matches. Duncan was the only one who remembered them the way they had been. Paul Atreides, Lady Jessica, Thufir Hawat, Cheney, Stilgar, Liet Kynes, Dr. Yui, and the baby, Leto II. They were just children now, innocent and sweet, an unorthodox group with mismatched ages. Right now, in one of the bright chambers, Paul and his oddly younger mother were playing together, happily arranging toy soldiers and military equipment around a mock castle. The oldest Gola, Paul, was calm, full of intelligence and curiosity. He looked exactly like the images in the Bene Gesserit archives of the child who had spent his early years at Castle Caladan. Duncan remembered him well. The decision to create the next Gola, Jessica, had sparked much debate on the no-ship. In her first life, Lady Jessica had thrown the sisterhood's careful breeding plans into complete turmoil. She had made rash decisions based on her conscience and her heart, forcing the sisterhood to revise centuries-old schemes. Some among Shiana's followers felt that Jessica's advice and input could prove invaluable. Others disagreed, vehemently. Next, Teg and Duncan had lobbied strongly for the return of Thufir Hawat, knowing that the warrior Mentat could assist them in a critical battle situation. They also wanted Duke Leto Atreides, another great leader, though initially there had been difficulties with the cellular material. Muad'Dib's beloved Cheney had also been one of the early priorities, if only as a mechanism to control the potential Kwisatz Haderach, should he show signs of becoming what they most feared. But they knew very little about the original girl. As the daughter of a Fremen, Cheney's early life had made no mark in the Bene Gesserit records, so much of her past remained a mystery. Their sketchy information came from her later association with Paul and the fact that she was the daughter of Liet Kynes, the visionary planetologist who had rallied the people of Dune to turn their desert world into a garden. Yes, Liet Kynes was also there, and 2 years younger than his own daughter. We must dispense with our preconceptions of family, Duncan thought. Details of age and convoluted parentage were no odder than the existence of these children at all. The Bene Gesserit committee had chosen to bring back Kynes for his long-term thinking ability and large-scale planning. For similar reasons, they restored the great Fremen leader Stilgar a year later. There was also a Gola of Wellington Yue, the great traitor who had caused the downfall of House Atreides and the death of Duke Leto. History reviled Yue, so Duncan didn't understand the Sisterhood's rationale behind resurrecting him. Why Yue? And not yet, for example, Gurney Halleck? Perhaps the Bene Gesserits simply considered him an interesting experiment, a test case. So many historical figures here, Duncan thought, including myself. He glanced up at a panel of surveillance imagers high on the walls. The creche chamber, the med center, the library rooms, and the play chamber were closely monitored by such equipment. As Duncan watched silently, he saw the Golas take notice of him one by one. They looked at him with adult eyes in children's bodies, and then they went back to playing, wrestling, making up games, experimenting with toys. Though the activities seemed perfectly ordinary, a group of proctors diligently recorded every interaction and toy selection, every childish brawl. They noted preferences in colors, blossoming friendships, and analyzed each result for possible significance. The Bashar Miles Teg, another reincarnated legend, entered the chamber. Standing half a head taller than Duncan, he wore dark trousers and a white shirt with a gold starburst insignia on the collar, the symbol of his past rank as the Bashar. I never get over how strange it is to see them like this, Miles. It makes me think we played God, voting on which ones to resurrect and which to keep under cellular lockup. Some decisions were obvious. Though the cells were there, we chose not to bring back another Baron Harkonnen, Count Fenring, or Peiter de Vries. He frowned in disapproval as the black-haired baby Leto II cried after losing a sandworm toy to a 3-year-old Liet Kynes. Duncan said, I loved little Leto and his sister Ganema when they were orphaned twins. And as the God Emperor, Leto killed me time and again. Sometimes when that Gola baby looks at me, I think he already has his tyrant memories. He shook his head. Teg said, some of the most conservative sisters already say we have created a monster. Leto II, though smaller than Kynes, fought fiercely for the toy. His death resulted in the scattering, the famine times, and now because of that great, reckless dispersal of people, we have provoked an enemy to come after us. Is that really an acceptable end to his golden path? Duncan raised his eyebrows and mused at Teg, Mentat to Mentat. Who is to say the golden path is at an end? Even after all this time, this may still be part of Leto's plan. I would not underestimate his prescience. As Golas themselves, he and Teg had assumed many of the responsibilities for the program. The real difficulties wouldn't arise for years yet, when the children reached a level of maturity sufficient to prepare them for reawakening their memories. Instead of hiding information from the Golas, Duncan insisted that they be granted full access to data about their previous lives, in the hope of turning them into effective weapons more quickly. These children were all double-edged swords. They could hold keys to saving the no-ship from future crises, or they could raise dangers of their own. The new Golas were more than flesh and bone, more than individual personalities. They represented a stunning array of potential talents. As if making a command decision, Tag marched into the room, separated the two quarreling children, and found additional toys to keep them content. As Duncan watched, he recalled how many times he had tried to assassinate the God Emperor himself, and how many times Leto II had brought him back as a Gola. Gazing at the one-year-old child, Duncan thought, if anyone could find a way to live forever, it would be him. Every judgment teeters on the brink of error. To claim absolute knowledge is to become monstrous. Knowledge is an unending adventure at the edge of uncertainty. Leto Atreides II, the God Emperor. From ocean to desert, blue world to brown sand. Leaving newly conquered Boozel, Mirbella returned to Chapter House to oversee the growing wasteland. From the keep on Chapter House, she took an ornithopter, piloting it herself. Perfectly self-sufficient, she flew the thopter out over the fast-growing dunes where the worm's domain was spreading. She gazed down at the brittle and leafless branches of what had been a thick forest. The trees reached upward like drowning men trying to fend off a slow tidal wave of obliterating sand. Soon, the new desert, beautiful in its own way, would engulf the whole planet, just like Rakkis. "I chose to make the ecosystem die as swiftly as possible," said the voice of Odraid within. "It was the humane thing to do." "It is easier to create a wasteland than a garden." There was nothing easy about this. Not easy on Chapter House, and not easy on my conscience, or on mine. Mirbella stared down at the sterile emptiness. The bones of an environment lay down there, desiccating in the hot afternoon sun. All part of the detailed Bene Gesserit plan. But it is what we have to do for spice, for power, for control. To make the Spacing Guild, Trome, Richesi, and all planetary governments do as we command. That is what survival is all about, child. Only a few months ago, this area had been forest. Careful not to waste their dwindling resources, the sisters had begun logging in the area after the trees died, but the desert had spread too quickly for them to finish. Now, with Bene Gesserit efficiency, work teams cut transient roads through the sand and drove large haulers into the dead forest. They dug out the trunks, cut the dry boughs, and removed the wood for construction material and fuel. The dead trees were no longer part of a viable ecosystem, so the sisterhood would make use of the lumber. Mirbella abhorred waste. She veered off into the broader region of dunes that stretched in seemingly endless succession like immense ocean waves frozen in time. Like living organisms, sand dunes were always on the move, churning countless silica particles in an excruciatingly slow tsunami. Sand and fertile land had always engaged in a great cosmic dance, each trying to lead, as honored Matres and Bene Gesserits were doing now. The Mother Commander's thoughts turned to Belanda and Doria, both forced to cooperate for the good of the sisterhood. For years, the two had jointly overseen spice operations, though she knew they still hated working together. Now, unannounced, Mirbella flew far out over the sand in her unmarked thopter. Below, She spotted Chapter House workers as well as off-worlder support staff setting up a temporary spice harvesting camp on a patch of orange sand. The vein of fresh spice was large for Chapter House, minuscule by the former standards of Rakkus, and a mere speck compared to what the Tliloxu had once produced in their axolotl tanks. But the patches were growing, and so were the worms that produced them. Choosing a landing site, the mother commander banked the aircraft and slowed the flapping motion of the wings. She saw her two spice ops directors standing together on the sand, taking silicon or bacteriological samples for laboratory analysis. Several isolated research stations had already been established far out in the desert belt, allowing scientific teams to analyze possible spice blows. Harvesting equipment waited to be deployed. Small scrapers and gatherers, not the monstrous hovering carry-alls and factories that had once been used on Rakkus. After landing the ornithopter, Mirbella just sat in the cabin, not yet ready to emerge. Belanda trudged over, brushing gritty dust from her work clothes. With an expression of annoyance on her sunburned face, Doria followed, squinting into the sunlight that reflected off the cockpit. Finally emerging, Mirbella drew a warm, dry breath that smelled more of bitter dust than of melange. Out here in the desert, I feel a sense of serenity, of eternal calmness. I wish I did. Doria dropped her heavy pack and kit onto the dirt. When will you assign someone else to work the spice operations? I am quite content with my responsibilities, Belanda said, primarily to irritate Doria. Mirbella sighed at their petulant competitiveness and bantering. We need spice and sou stones, and we need cooperation. Show me you are worthy, Doria, and perhaps I will send you to Boozle, where you can complain about the cold and damp, rather than the arid heat. For now, my command is that you work here, with Belanda. And Belle, your assignment is to remember what you are and to make Doria into a superior sister. The wind blew stinging sand into their faces, but Mirbella forced herself not to blink. Belanda and Doria stood side by side, wrestling with their displeasure. The former honored Matre was the first to give a curt nod. You are the Mother Commander. Back in the keep that evening, Mirbella went to her workroom to study Belanda's meticulous projections of how much spice they could expect to harvest in coming years from the fledgling desert, and how swiftly productivity would rise. The new sisterhood had expended spice widely enough from their stockpiles that outsiders believed they had an inexhaustible supply. In time, though, their secret hoards could dwindle to nothing more than a cinnamony aftertaste. She compared the amount to the sou stone profits starting to roll in from Boozle, and then to the payments the Richesian weapons shops demanded. Outside, through the keep's windows, she saw distant, silent flashes of lightning, as if the gods had muted the sounds of the changing weather. Then, as if in response to her thoughts, dry wind began to pummel the keep, accompanied by claps of thunder. She went to the window, looked out at the twisting tongues of dust and a few dead leaves swirling along a footpath between buildings. The storm intensified, and a startling patter of large raindrops struck the dusty plaza, leaving streaks in the blown grit. The weather of Chapter House had been in upheaval for years, but she didn't recall weather control ever planning a rainstorm over the keep. Mirbella couldn't remember the last time rain had come down like this. An unexpected storm. Many dangerous storms were out there, not just the oncoming enemy. The most powerful strongholds of the honored Matres remained on various worlds like festering sores. And still, No one knew where the honored Matres had come from or what they had done to provoke the relentless enemy. Humanity had evolved in the wrong direction for too long, wandering down a blind path, the golden path, and the damage might be irreversible. With the outside enemy coming, Mirbella feared they might well be on the threshold of the greatest storm of all. Krahlazek, Arafel, Armageddon, Ragnarok. By any name, the darkness at the end of the universe. The rain outside lasted for only a few moments, but the howling wind continued long into the night. Do our enemies occur naturally, or do we create them through our own actions? Mother Superior Alma Mavis Terraza, Bene Gesserit Archives, Open Records for Acolytes. The very existence of the Leto II Gola was an offense to Garimi. Little tyrant. A baby with the destruction of the human race in his genes. How many more reminders of Bene Gesserit's shame and human failure must they face? How could her fellow sisters refuse to learn from mistakes? Blind hubris and foolishness. From the very beginning, Garimi and her staunchly conservative allies had argued against the creation of these historical golas, for obvious reasons. Those figures had already lived their lifetimes. Many had caused great damage and turned the universe upside down. Leto II, the god emperor of Dune, who became known as the Tyrant, was the worst by far. Garimi shuddered to think of the unspeakably huge risks Shiana was taking with all of them. Not even Paul Atreides, the long sought after and yet uncontrolled Kwisatz Haderach, had caused as much damage as Leto II. Paul had at least maintained an element of caution, keeping part of his humanity and refusing to do the terrible things that his own son had later embraced. Muad'Dib at least had the good grace to feel guilty. But not Leto II. The tyrant had sacrificed his humanity from the beginning. Without remorse, he had accepted the awful consequences of merging with a sandworm, and he forged ahead, plowing through history like a whirlwind, casting innocent lives around him like discarded chaff. Even he had known how hated he would be when he said, "I am necessary, so that never again in all of history will you need someone like me." And now Shiana had brought the little monster back, despite the risk that he might do even more damage. But Duncan, Teg, Shiana, and others felt Leto II might be the most powerful of all the Golas. Most powerful? Most dangerous instead. At the moment, Leto was just a one-year-old baby in the creche, helpless and weak. He would never be this vulnerable again. Garimi and her loyal sisters decided to make their move without delay. Morally, they had no choice but to destroy him. She and her broad-shouldered companion Stuka slipped along the dim corridors of the Ithaca. In deference to ancient human biological cycles, Duncan, the captain, had imposed a regular diurnal shifting of bright lights and dimness to simulate days and nights. Though it was not necessary to adhere to such a clock, most people aboard found it socially convenient to do so. Together, the two women stalked around corners and dropped through tubes and lift platforms from one deck to the next. Now, as most of the passengers prepared for sleep, she and Stuka entered the silent creche near the expansive medical chambers. 2-year-old Stilgar and 3-year-old Liet Kynes were in the nursery, while the other 5 young Golas were with proctors. Leto II was the only baby currently in the creche, though the axolotl tanks were sure to create more eventually. Using her knowledge of the ship's controls, Garimi worked from the hull station to bypass the observation imagers. She wanted no record of the supposed crime that she and Stuka were about to commit, though Garimi knew she could not keep her secret for long. Many of the Reverend Mothers aboard were truthsayers. They could ferret out the murderers with proven methods of interrogation, even if they had to question all the refugees aboard. Garimi had made her choice. Stuka, too, swore she would sacrifice her life to do what was right. And if the two of them didn't succeed, Garimi knew at least a dozen other sisters who would gladly do the same, given the chance. She looked at her friend and partner. "Are you ready for this?" Stuka's wide face, though young and smooth, seemed to carry an infinite age and sadness. "I have made my peace." She took a deep breath. "I must not fear. Fear is the mind killer." The two sisters intoned the rest of the litany together. Garimi found that it had never ceased to be useful. With the surveillance imagers successfully deactivated, the pair entered the creche, using all of the Bene Gesserit's stealth and silence they could manage. Baby Leto lay in one of the small monitored cradles, by all appearances an innocent little child, looking so human. "Innocent," Garimi sneered. How deceptive appearances could be. She certainly did not need Stuka's assistance. It should be simple enough to smother the little monster. Nevertheless, the two angry Bene Gesserits shored up each other's confidence. Stuka looked down at Leto and whispered to her companion. "In his original life, the tyrant's mother died in childbirth, and a face dancer tried to murder the twins when they were only hours old. Their father went off blind into the desert, leaving the babies to be raised by others. Neither Leto nor his twin sister were ever held warmly in their parents' arms." Garimi shot her a sour glance. "Don't start going soft on me," she husked. "This is more than just a baby. In that crib lies a beast, not a mere child. But we do not know where or when the Tliloxu acquired the cells to make this gola. How could scrapings have been stolen from the immense God Emperor? If that was truly where the cells came from, why wasn't he born as a half-man, half-sandworm? More likely, they kept secret samplings of the boy Leto's cells from before he underwent his transformation. That means this child is technically still an innocent, his cells taken from an innocent body. Even when he gets his memories back, he will not be the hated God Emperor." Garimi glowered at her. "Do we dare take that risk? Even as children, Leto II and his twin sister Ganima had special and awesome powers of prescience. No matter what else, this is still an Atreides. He still has all the genetic markers that led to two dangerous Kwisatz Haderachs. That cannot be denied." Her voice began to grow too loud. Glancing down at the stirring baby, Garimi saw his bright eyes looking at her with a startling sentience, his mouth slightly open. Leto seemed to know why she was there. He recognized her, and yet he did not flinch. "If he is prescient," Stuka said uncertainly, "then maybe he knows what we're going to do to him." "I was thinking exactly the same thing." As if in response, one of the monitoring alarms bleeped, and Garimi raced to the controls in order to bypass them. She could not allow a signal to alert the Sook doctors. "Quickly! We have no more time. Do it now, or I will. The other woman picked up a thick pillow and raised it above the baby's face. Garimi frantically worked at the alarm panel as Stuka pushed the pillow down to smother him. Then Stuka screamed, and Garimi whirled to see a brief flash of tan segments, a writhing shape that rose up from the monitoring cradle. Stuka recoiled in panic. The pillow in her hands was shredded, its fabric spraying out in tatters. Garimi couldn't believe what she was seeing. Her vision seemed to be doubled, as if two separate things were occurring in the same place at the same time. A wide-ringed mouth of tiny crystalline teeth lashed out from the crib, striking the broad-shouldered woman in the side. There was a splash of blood. Gulping panicked breaths, Stuka clutched at a gash that ripped through her robes and laid open the skin down to the ribs. Garimi stumbled forward, but by the time she got to the cradle, she saw only the quietly resting baby Leto. The boy lay back, gazing up at her calmly with his bright eyes. Ceasing her cries of pain, Stuka used her Bene Gesserit abilities to stop the flow of blood from the jagged tear in her side. She fought for balance as she reeled away from the crib, her eyes wide. Garimi looked from her back to the baby in its cradle. Had she truly seen that baby transform into a sandworm? There were no surveillance images. Garimi could never prove what she thought she had seen. But how else to explain Stuka's wound? What are you, little tyrant? Garimi saw no blood on the baby's tiny fingers or mouth. Leto blinked back at her. The creche door burst open, and Duncan Idaho swept in, followed by two proctors. Duncan stood there, his face dark with anger, saw the blood, the shredded pillow, the baby in its crib. What in the seven hells are you doing here? Garimi backed away from the crib, keeping her distance, afraid that little Leto might turn into the envisioned worm again and attack. Looking at Duncan's fiery eyes, she almost concocted a lie that Stuka had come to kill the baby and that she, Garimi, had arrived in time to defend the child. But that lie would crumble quickly upon further examination. Instead, she drew herself up straight. A souk doctor arrived in response to the alarms Duncan had triggered. After checking the baby, she went to where Stuka had collapsed in fatigue. Shiana peeled away the tattered robe to expose the deep gash that had bled extensively before Stuka, in a surge of energy, managed to staunch the flow. Duncan and the proctors stared at it in awe. Garimi tore her gaze away, now more fearful of the baby than ever. She gestured angrily at the cradle. I suspected this child was a monster before. Now I have no doubt whatsoever. Despite the words of egalitarians, all humans are not the same. Each of us contains a unique mix of hidden potential. In times of crisis, we must discover these abilities before it is too late. Bashar Miles Teg. During the uproar that followed the attempt on baby Leto's life, Miles Teg watched the predictable power plays among the Bene Gesserit. The initial escape from Chapter House had made them set aside their differences for a time, but over the years, factions had formed and festered like unhealed wounds. The schism grew as time passed, and the Gola children provided a powerful wedge. In recent years, Teg had observed smoldering embers of uneasiness and resistance among Garimi's faction, centered around the new Golas. The crisis over Leto II had been like touching an igniter to kindlings soaked with accelerant. Teg's mother had raised him on Lernaeus, guiding him in Bene Gesserit ways. Janet Roxborough Tegg was loyal to the sisterhood, though not mindlessly so. She taught her son useful skills, showed him how to protect himself from Bene Gesserit tricks, and made him aware of how the ambitious women schemed. A true Bene Gesserit would take any necessary action to achieve a desired goal. But the attempted murder of a child? Tegg was concerned that even Shiana had miscalculated the risks. Garimi and Stuka stood defiantly in the boxes of the accused, not bothering to hide their guilt. The heavy doors of the large audience chamber were sealed, as if someone feared the two women might try to flee the no-ship. The thick air in the confined room had the sour, pungent odor of melange exuded from perspiration. The other women were quite agitated, and even most of the conservative faction had turned against Garimi for now. "You have acted against the sisterhood." Shiana gripped the edge of the podium. Her voice projected loud and clear as she raised her chin, her blue-within-blue eyes flashing. She had tied back her thick, copper-streaked hair, revealing the dusky skin of her face. Shiana was not much older than Garimi, but as acting leader of the shipboard Bene Gesserits, she projected the authority of much greater age. "You have broken a trust. Do we not have enough enemies already?" "It seems you do not see all of them, Shiana," Garimi said. "You create new ones in our own axolotl tanks. We have welcomed disagreement and discussion, and we have made our decision. As Bene Gesserits. Are you a tyrant yourself, Garimi, whose wishes simply tread over the will of the majority?" Even the staunch conservatives grumbled at that. Garimi's knuckles turned white as she stood there. From the front row next to Duncan, Tegg observed with his mentat abilities. The plasmetal bench beneath him was unyielding, but he hardly felt it. Young Leto II had been brought into the gathering chamber. An eerily quiet child, his bright eyes watched all activities around him. Shiana continued, "These historical golas may be our chance for survival, and you tried to kill the one who could be the greatest help of all." Garimi scowled. "My descent is a matter of record, Shiana." "Disagreement is one thing," Tegg said aloud, his voice carrying the weight of command. "Attempted assassination is quite another." Garimi glared at the Bashar for interrupting. Stuka spoke. "Is it assassination when one kills a monster instead of a human?" "Have a care," Duncan said. "The Bashar and I are also golas." "I do not call him a monster because he is a gola," Garimi said, gesturing toward the toddler. "We saw him. He carries the worm within him. That innocent baby transformed into a creature that attacked Stuka. You have all seen her wounds." "Yes, and we have heard your imaginative explanation." Shiana's voice dripped with skepticism. Garimi and Stuka looked deeply offended and turned to the sisters in the raised benches, lifting their hands for support. "We are still Bene Gesserit. We are well trained in observation and in the manipulation of beliefs and superstitions. We are not frightened children. That abomination transformed into a worm to defend himself from Stuka. Ask us to repeat our stories before a truthsayer." "I have no doubt that you believe what you say you saw," Shiana said. Speaking with utter calm, Duncan interjected, "The Gola baby has been tested, as have all the new Golas. His cellular structure is perfectly normal, exactly as we expected. We checked and double-checked the original cells from Cytale's null entropy capsule. This is Leto II, and nothing more."
"Nothing more?"
Garimi let out a sarcastic laugh. As if being the tyrant is not enough? The Tleilaxu could have tampered with his genetics. We found Face Dancer cells among the other material. You know not to trust them. The Tleilaxu master was not there to defend himself against the accusations. Looking at Duncan, Shiana admitted, such tampering has been done before. A Gola can have unexpected abilities, or an unexpected time bomb inside. Teg watched their attention turn to him. He was an adult now, but they still remembered his origin from the first Bene Gesserit axolotl tanks. There could be no question about his genetics. Teg had been produced under the direct control of the Bene Gesserit. No Tleilaxu had ever had an opportunity to meddle. None of the refugees here, not even Duncan Idaho, knew that Teg could move at impossible speeds, and that he sometimes had the ability to see no fields that were invisible even to the most sophisticated scanners. Despite the Bashar's proven loyalty, though, the Sisterhood had too many suspicions. They saw nightmare hints of another Kwisatz Haderach everywhere. The Bene Gesserit are not the only ones who can keep secrets. He spoke up. Yes, we all have hidden potential within us. Only fools refuse to use their potential. Shiana looked hard at the stern, dark-haired Garimi, who had once been her close friend and protege. Garimi crossed her arms, trying to control her obvious indignation. Under other circumstances, I might have imposed banishment and exile. However, we cannot afford to diminish our numbers. Where would we send you? To execution? I think not. We have already split from Chapter House, and we've had few enough children in the intervening 13 years. Do I dare eliminate you, Garimi, and your supporters? Crumbling factions are what one would expect from a weak and power-mad cult. We are Bene Gesserit. We are better than that. Then what do you suggest, Shiana? Garimi stepped out of the box of the accused and strode toward the podium where Shiana stood. I cannot simply ignore my convictions, and you cannot ignore our supposed crime. The Golas, all of them, will be tested again. If you are proved correct that this child is a threat, then there was no crime committed. In fact, you will have saved us all. However, if you are wrong, then you will formally rescind your objections. She crossed her own arms, mirroring Garimi. The Sisterhood has made its decision, and you defied it. I am fully prepared to grow another Gola of Leto II, or another 10 Golas, to ensure that at least one survives. 11 Golas of Duncan were killed before we charged the Bashar with protecting him. Is that what you want us to do, Garimi? The look of horror in the other woman's eyes was the only answer Shiana needed. In the meantime, I assign you to watch over Leto II as his guardian. In fact, you are now responsible for all of the Golas as the official Proctor Superior. Garimi and her followers were stunned. Shiana smiled at their disbelief. Everyone in the chamber knew that responsibility for the 1-year-old boy's life now lay solely with Garimi. Teg could not control his faint smile. Shiana had devised a perfect Bene Gesserit punishment. Garimi did not dare let anything happen to him. Recognizing that she was trapped, Garimi nodded curtly. I will watch. And I will discover what dangers lurk within him. When I do, I expect you to take the necessary action. Necessary action only. Leto II sat innocently in his padded chair, a small, helpless-looking baby, with 3,500 years of tyrannical memories locked away inside of him. After staring again at cottages at Cordville, Shiana lay in her quarters, drifting in and out of sleep, her thoughts troubled and overactive. Neither Serena Butler nor Audrade had come back to whisper to her in some time, but she felt a deeper disturbance churning in other memory, an uneasiness. As fatigue fuzzed her thoughts, she sensed an odd sort of trap enfolding her, a vision that drew her under more than a dream. She tried to awaken to the alarming change, but could not. Browns and grays swirled around her, and she saw a brightness beyond that drew her closer, pulling her body through the colors toward the light. Sounds intruded like a screaming wind, and a dry dustiness invaded her lungs, making her cough. Abruptly, the turmoil and noise subsided, and she found herself standing on sand, with great rolling dunes extending from the foreground to the farthest horizons. Was it the Rakkas of her childhood? Or perhaps an even older planet? Oddly, though she stood barefoot in her sleeping clothes, she could not feel the surface beneath her, nor did she feel the heat from the bright sun overhead. Her throat, however, was parched. Surrounded by empty dunes, it seemed pointless to walk or run in any direction, and so she waited. Shiana bent over and picked up a handful of sand. Lifting her hand high, she spilled the sand, letting it fall. But it formed an odd hourglass in the air, particles filtering slowly through an imaginary constricted opening. She watched the invisible bottom chamber begin to fill. Did it mean that time was running out? For whom? Convinced that this was more than a dream, she wondered if she could be experiencing a journey into other memory that was not just voices, but actual experiences. Tactile visions encompassed all of her senses, like reality. Had she taken a path to some other place? Just as the no-ship had once slipped through into an alternate universe? As she stood in the middle of the wasteland, the sand continued to trickle through the ethereal hourglass. Would a sandworm come if this landscape was meant to replicate the planet Dune? She saw a distant figure on one of the dune tops, a woman moving over the sand with a well-practiced and intentionally uneven gait, as if she had spent all her life doing it. The stranger glided down the dune face toward Shiana, then disappeared in a valley between the undulating dunes. Moments later, she reappeared on top of a closer mound of sand. The woman went down one dune and up another, coming closer to her, growing larger. In the foreground, sand continued to whisper through the bottleneck of the invisible hourglass in the air. Finally, the woman crested the last dune and hurried down the visible face directly toward Shiana. Oddly, she left no footprints and spilled no loose sand. Now Shiana could see that she wore an old-style stillsuit with a black hood. Even so, a few strands of gray hair drifted around a face so dry and leathery it looked like driftwood. Her rheumy eyes were the deepest blue within blue Shiana had ever seen. She must have consumed a great deal of spice for many years and seemed incredibly ancient. "I speak with the voice of the multitude," the crone said in an eerie, echoing voice. Her teeth were yellow and crooked. "You know what I mean." "The multitude, other memory. You speak for dead sisters."
"I speak for eternity, for all who have lived and all who are yet unborn. I am Sayedina Ramalo. Long ago,
Chaney and I administered the water of life to Lady Jessica, the mother of Muad'Dib. She pointed a gnarled finger toward a distant formation of rocks. It was over there. And now you have brought them all back. Ramallo. Shiana knew of the old woman, a key figure in the epic of recorded history. In sending Jessica through the agony in a Fremen CH, not realizing she was pregnant, Ramallo had unknowingly changed the fetus inside. The daughter, Aaliyah, had been called an abomination. The Syedina seemed remote, a mere mouthpiece for the turmoil in other memory. Hear my words, Shiana, and heed them closely. Be careful what you create. You bring back too much, too quickly. A simple thing can have great repercussions. You want me to stop the Gola project altogether? On the no-ship, Aaliyah's cells were also among those preserved in the Tliloxu Master's null entropy capsule. Ramallo, in other memory, must have seen the infamous abomination as her greatest, most tragic error, though the old Syedina had not lived to know Aaliyah. You want me to avoid Aaliyah? One of the other Golas? Aaliyah was to be the next Gola child created, the first of a new batch that included Serena Butler, Xavier Harkonnen, Duke Leto Atreides, and many others. Caution, child. Heed my words. Take time. Proceed cautiously over dangerous terrain. Shiana moved closer to the figure. But what does that mean? Should we wait a year? 5 years? Just then the sand in the imaginary hourglass ran out